communications coordinator at Holden Village, and one of the most wonderful things I've been doing is this summer, I just wanted to be able to keep an eye on Michael.
Don't run out. I'll let you know when I'm going.
I didn't want you hiding behind the piece of furniture. One of the fun things that I've been able to do this summer is sit in the Bombardier that we turned into a sound studio and record people's stories and talk to them. And I just, they've been funny stories. They've been tremendously moving. And Michael has started up telling me, well, I don't have a story because I'm here for the first time, and then told me this magnificent story about how he got here for the first time. So we all have them, but we may not recognize the story that is with us, or the story that might make a difference to others. And so the idea of these sessions, we've had really three ways for people to tell their stories about Holden and their experiences here. One, I hope you've noticed the journals in your rooms, and I really encourage you to write in those journals. Even if it's your first time, there's something, there's a story there. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have a story. So the journals is one way, recording in the Bombardier one individual at a time is another way, and then sitting around the campfire more or less is the third way. So every week we've invited people to come and share their experiences, their memories, maybe what it was like the first time they came, what irritates them about Holden Village. What has changed about Holden Village that should never have been changed, and stories like that. I'll just put a teaser out there. By the way, all these little yellow slips coming out are, if you're stuck, I will go through some of the stories that I've heard, but. So many people have told me that Holden, their lives are fundamentally changed because they've had the Holden experience, and I just wonder if anybody has that kind of a story to tell or would like to approach that topic, or maybe knows of somebody whose life was fundamentally changed because of the village, because of their experience here.
One of the, this is my first time here. I'm a pastor from Central Kansas. And one of my, for 30 years I wanted to come to Holden. And back in 1981 or 82 in my first parish, I wrote a letter. In those days you wrote letters, to somebody here at Holden asking if I could come do some continuing education here at Holden. And I don't recall what the letter said, but it was something like, we don't have anything quite like that you're looking for as a pastor. And I don't know what the program was. I don't know why I received an answer like that. But through the years, I've always wanted to come here. And now, this is the first time in my ministry of almost 35 years that I have a three-month sabbatical. And this was the first place that I felt I wanted to come, just because it was a wonderful place. But one of the people that that I've talked to over the last year or so, since finding out that I had a sabbatical and knowing that somebody was here, was Harry Grinstadt. Harry served for 2 years. Anybody know Harry Grinstadt? He served, I think, for 2 years here at Holden back in the, it probably would have been the late 90s, before I went to seminary. And he serves a church about 12 miles from where I serve. Came from Bellingham originally, and now serves at the church's name is New Gotland Lutheran Church in McPherson, Kansas. And my sense in talking to Harry is that this was a very formative time for him, the time he spent here. And there's a woman named Lydia who's a good friend of his. She's here working in a volunteer. Can't think of her last name.
But
she's one of the longtime visitors and volunteers here, I think. But he has indicated to me that this was a formative in his discerning to become a pastor, for example. And I know that's not unusual in this community for people to become pastors after they've been here for a short time or a long time. I just wanted to lift his name up, not only to give my story a little bit, but someone who I think was affected greatly by his time here.
And when was it the first time you wrote?
It must have been 1981 or 82.
How long will you be here?
2 weeks. That's almost a week now, and it'll be till next.
Any first impressions you wanted to
share? You know, it is a wonderful experience to be here, and I'm a hiker. I love the outdoors, and I've done a lot of hiking and hope to do a little more since when I'm here. You know, I'm really struck by the community that is here. You know, it's a liturgical place. Worship has a very central place in this community. The fellowship is very close-knit. It is a family in some ways, and it's a very attractive place to spend. For me, it's been 5 days, and trust it will be for the next 6 or 7 as well.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
The community aspect is so powerful. I wonder if anybody, if that lights a thought in anyone's mind or a memory about community, Larry?
In line with what you shared, I'm married to Nancy Winder, and her history goes back to early 70s. She came up here as a volunteer and had gone to St. Olaf and graduated with a religion and Spanish major, double major, but didn't really know what she wanted to do. So she came up here for a year and encountered Carol Hinder, the first longtime executive director. And he was a very powerful influence on her. But as she tells the story, she was giving matins one day. And after she had given the matins, as she remembers it, 33 people came up to her and said, "You should be a pastor." Like, talk about community. The community just nailed her. And she couldn't get that out of her head. So she finished her year and then went to Luther Seminary and became the first woman pastor in the Northwest available for call, and the 12th graduate from the Lutheran seminaries to be ordained. And so she kind of pioneered the operation, but it was because this community said, "You're ahead, go do it."
And
pretty powerful.
And her first call
was here.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted a woman pastor in the Northwest. And so she came here for 2 years, 76 to 78, and then went to Bishop Solberg in Seattle, who had the Pacific Northwest district at that time. And he said, "If you're willing to stick this out, I am." He says, "Because if we don't make this work, it's going to set things back years in the Northwest." So she took a series of 3 interim calls, lasting most of 3 years, not quite 3 years. And in that process, you get community in because her colleagues, all men, invited her to preach while they were in the church. Not on vacation, not on sabbatical, not sick, but there. And it was almost like they were saying, now look, folks, pay attention. You know, we honor the office. Whatever's in that office, we honor it. And note how this woman can preach and deliver the word. And so she talked and preached in about 80 congregations, and we've got 120 at that time or so. And finally she landed a call at our church in Seattle. I was on the call committee. And, you know, I married Nancy in 94 because my first wife died in 93. And it was a very interesting process because, you know, we were going the usual route of saying, well, we want a person with 20 years of experience and we don't want to pay anything, and so on and so forth. And so the assistant to the bishop, Cliff Lundy, called up and said, I have another name to offer you. Well, who's that? We were a rather independent bunch. We had developed our own list. And he said, Nancy Winder. And he said, well, what has she done? She said, well, she was a pastor at Holden, and she's had some interim calls. He said, well, that's not the experience level we want. End of discussion. He said, I really want you to consider this woman. And so we said, okay, send us the package. So they did. And all the men sitting around call committee table, we talked about it. Just wasn't going to fly. And finally, one of the men said, you know, if I had a daughter in this situation, I'd be really upset. That wasn't exactly the word that the person used. I can't use it in this company. If I had a daughter in this position, I'd be really upset if we didn't at least talk to her. And the whole room just went quiet. That was it. So we interviewed her, and she was by far the best candidate. And so she stayed with us for 30 years. But it was a very interesting journey for all of us. You know, it was early in the ballgame for within pastors.
And that brings up, as I understand the history of Holden, and I've been researching a lot lately, that the village has tended to be on the cutting edge of change in the church. I wonder if anybody has experiences or thoughts about that topic.
Well, the first time we came here, they told us, somebody told us, I don't know who it was anymore, that the church was wanting to sort of isolate the liberals. And they thought this was a good thing. And then they discovered they bred up here. And our very first time we ever came here was in 91 or 92, I forget. And we've only been here 6 times. We don't quite make it all the time from Ohio. But we got off the boat and found out it was Gay Lesbian Week. And we
really
thought,
there was a sign, Gay Lesbian Week?
Well, it was,
I don't know.
Yeah, and there were other speakers, but this was the focus. And there was also a board meeting that week. And I believe the first meal we had was rice and rice and rice. And we thought, well, this is going to be an interesting week. And it wasn't quite a whole week, I guess. But it was one of, you know, I was thinking when you first asked about changing your life, I said, no, I mean, we've always been in that liberal group or something. But then I got to thinking, that week changed a lot because we met parents of gay, lesbian people. We met the people themselves. We met brothers and sisters. We met a bishop whose daughter was gay. We met just such a variety of people. And we listened. I remember these two gentlemen who lived in Florida. And they had taken, were foster parents of children who were in some way ill in ways in which they would never, ever be able to be adopted. They'd never, ever be able to be anything because they were so fragile. Well, with under their care, they got better. And so now they could be adopted. But these guys couldn't adopt them because the state law forbid them. And they were in the process of trying to fight that. I never did find out what happened. But, you know, there were all those kinds of stories in that just really impacted us. And the two leading persons who were there, I can't think of their names either, they were two women pastors who were about to be kicked out of the church because they were in a committed relationship. And if they would give it up, they could be a pastor. But if they didn't, they couldn't. And they weren't. And then there were also two men pastors, although I don't remember if they were all there all that time. But it was so funny because I hadn't really thought a lot about it at that time. That was a long time ago. And as we were leaving, the one gal came up to me and she says, "You're still not sure, are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm thinking a lot." And I said, "I really enjoyed you and I enjoyed this week and all the stories, but I've got to think a lot." And she says, "Don't worry about it." And I believe she was the one whose dad was a bishop. She says, "Don't worry about it. I didn't like myself either for a long, long time. And it took me a long time to like myself. You'll get there. But don't rush it. Just take your time and think about it and pray." And so I guess in a sense that has been a changing week of my life. I still don't like having only rice. I'm sorry. But everything else is very good.
Along those same lines, when Nancy and I were here for a year, 2009-2010, the directors got a letter, and the letter was read to the assembled community. A pastor from somewhere in the Midwest had come out here and stayed for a week or two, I've forgotten which, and went back to the Midwest, and on the same subject, had rather life-changing experience. And it had an interesting twist to it because he had been a very, very vocal leader of the movement to take some churches out of the ELCA because of the concerns of how the church was voting on that issue. And so the bishop gets a letter from, gets a big check from this guy, big donation to the Synod. Bishop says, "This is odd. Why is he giving the Synod money when he wants to take a lot of churches out of the Synod?" So he calls him up. He says, I think I want to know more. What is behind this check?" The guy said, "Well, you know, I went to someplace called Holden Village. While I was there, learned a few things. I was wrong. And this is one way that I'm trying to make amends." Wow.
I know a few more people in Kansas we'd like to send up here.
But yeah, when that letter was read, the whole community just was deathly silent for a while. It just was, whoa, we don't remember the guy. We don't know who he was. We didn't do anything. But we did. Something did. Spirit, I don't know. But that was really a very powerful about how subtle this place can be. Sometimes it hits you between the eyes, other times it sneaks up on you, I guess. But a ton of stories like that.
I just want to share another way that Holden Village has impacted my ministry. About 15 years ago, I discovered, whenever it was, Holden Evening Prayer, and the three congregations I've served since then have just loved, and I do too. It's a marvelous service that is a tremendous Vesper service for not only this community but for the church.
Very accessible, and you're probably aware of our April Fool's Holden Evening Prayer April Fool's Day this year. We invited churches and organizations, and literally all over the world joined us in a synchronized celebration of Holden Evening Prayer on April Fool's Day, because that was the date on two of Wes Preeb's letters saying, "Hey, this village would make a good church camp or something," and response from the mining company saying, call us.
Would you mind telling me how the Holden prayer that we're talking about right now, how that evolved?
Yes, that Marty Haugen, the composer, was the village musician in residence in 1986. So within the village, it's actually called Vespers 86. Mm-hmm. And that's when he wrote it, and it just, people would come and hear it, and it was published. Interestingly enough, I'm told, Oxford turned it down first time around, and GIA, which is a Catholic publisher, picked it up and published it. Now it's available through both GIA and Oxford. Yeah. And speaking of music, I love the story you told last night at the concert about your first, would you mind for the, now that the microphone is on, I don't know that your concert was recorded, but I would love to hear that story.
Oh, sure. Well, Amy and I, actually, we lived here from 91 to 94, and, you know, mentioning Marty Haugen reminded me of the fact that, you know, we would, and I think it's still a tradition to do it weekly, the service. I'm thinking for 3 years there, we did that over 150 times, and I never got tired of it. It was Friday night when we were here, Friday nights. And you know, I love doing it in the Village Center in the summer, but there's something really special about doing it in this room in the winter with just the winter community. See some of us with our feet up on this circle here. I remember a community meeting in this room where and once a week on Wednesday nights during the winter, the community gathers in here, and I don't think they do this anymore, but I heard today that they don't do this, but it would be about a two-hour session, and people would bring their knitting and their craft projects, and they would discuss whatever was on their mind. There'd be someone sitting in the chair where you're sitting now and facilitating it, and facilitating this was really an art. I was always, there were certain folks who kind of sat in that chair, and it wasn't the director or the business manager, or it was, I remember the best facilitator we had was an electrician, and he would sit there and he was able to bring these various concerns, whatever they would be, that would bubble up in the context of the intensity of that experience, of that winter community experience, and get a conversation going and try to, if decisions needed to be made, try to facilitate consensus. It was really a learning experience. I will say that sometimes the discussions got a little bit on the absurd side, including the one time when we spent probably an hour discussing whether it's okay to put your feet up on this ring or not. And that may seem ridiculous now, but think about it, in the winter, this is like the altar, you know? So I, you know, in a way, it would be like us putting our feet up on the altar in the Village Center, we wouldn't think of it. But, and very heated discussions on both sides, and one person coming in, here, I'm going to be up, what are you going to do about it? And just some of that kind of stuff. But
the winters are long and cold.
You
have
to heat them up a little bit. And each winter community is different. You know, it's kind of, in a way, community can be maybe a misleading word, because community has kind of an aspect of continuing kind of a relationship or commitment. Communities here are very transient in nature. Each winter, we were here for 3 winters, each winter, which had a completely different feeling, because there was different people there. Probably about, what would you say, Amy, maybe a third of the folks would stay on, but a whole two-thirds new people were there. And we had some very difficult winter. One winter in particular was very difficult. We saw a lot of bad stuff, and you can't just shut your door, and if a family is falling apart here, as we witnessed and community experienced, watching this family of five kind of disintegrate in front of us, that could happen next door to you at home, anywhere else, and you'd never know about it until suddenly it happened, you know, but here it was something we all saw and experienced very close and personal, and we saw community split over taking sides on the issue, and you know, should people leave, should they stay, should, you know, this this group faction kind of in trying to support this family member, this, you know. So it could be pretty intense at times in the winter. And then the following winter was completely the opposite. And sometimes I think it was like we went into that next winter with the mindset of, you know what, we're just going to like chill out and just kind of like enjoy this place and not get go down the rabbit hole of all this, you know. Because we kind of, we did a lot of that last winter and we were all emotionally drained. And, you know, I think people may be interested to know that they did the Myers-Briggs test here one winter. It was before we arrived, and found out that 75% of the folks here stay the winter here are introverts and 25% are extroverts, which is the opposite of what you just did the general public at large and the, you know, randomly selected. So there's kind of a makeup of the winter that community can be a challenge in that context, but I think those of us, and Amy and I are both introverts, so we understand this. I think it's good. I think we a lot of us come and recognize this is good for us because we would probably just kind of revert into our, but it kind of forces you to get, you know, sharing your meals together, worshiping together, working together, struggling together, having celebrations together. When the sun finally gets over Buckskin Mountain, we put on our swimsuits and we go out and grill burgers and all the fun, you know, have this crazy party. Those of you who know the sun, once the sun gets over Buckskin Mountain in the winter, then you get about, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours more sunlight than you do otherwise. It rises at 11 o'clock on this side of Buckskin and it sets at about 1 in the afternoon in, on Copper. So the letter. So that's how we experienced Holden as a young couple, young married couple. We moved here right after we got married. Amy had never been to Holden. She came here, signed up for 2 years, sight unseen, and arrived in January.
And I was the head of lawns and gardens.
Oh, no.
And so I was planning for, I planted seeds in mow, which is very early in mow,
right.
Little rock that used to be for...
Did you have grow lights or something?
Yeah, it was full of grow lights. All the shelves were full, and I had wooden flats, and I sterilized the soil in the oven in the kitchen and planted all these seeds, and everything was growing and getting ready for spring, and I had no idea what the ground even looked like because it was, you know, feet of snow. But I knew there were hanging baskets and window boxes and all that that were going to be waiting. So, and then I worked in the kitchen as well. So that was my first experience at Holden, coming as a newlywed. And
yeah. Oh, and then we took, after we left Holden, it was about 10 years before our kids, I think, were old enough where we were ready to make, because we live in Michigan, kind of a big trip out here. And the story I told last night about one of the things, since I had been operations, I kind of thought, when we go back to Holden, it'd be fun to just do something totally different, you know? And not necessarily jump back into the operations side of things. So music was always our avocation as a family, so our girls were had just finished up a Suzuki program, and their strings, you know, playing and we were living in a small town. The Suzuki program folded within a year, and so we had these instruments and everything, and so it was about the time we were trying to think about coming out to Holden. So I wrote this letter saying, you know, kind of described this family that plays Celtic music together and leads worship and all this kind of stuff, and it existed in my mind. and then they wrote back, "Oh yeah, we'd like you to come and be village musicians for a couple weeks this summer." And they kind of gathered the family around. And, okay, you read the letter, and we've got 6 months to pull this off. But as Abby said this morning when we were at Matin, she said her favorite quote is, you know, take chances, try new things. Remember, professionals built the Titanic, amateurs built the Ark.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So we somehow got it together. I wouldn't recommend listening to our recording from that particular year in the Village Center, but.
I have to say that Holden has influenced us, like food-wise, after we lived here. At that time, it was really low on the food chain, was kind of the terminology. So a lot more vegetarian, just not much meat at all. And there was a cookbook that was published, and we still have that cookbook in our kitchen, and we still have spinach squares and babodi and egg kaka, and pull up the Holden cookbook occasionally, and we have those meals together and kind of celebrate our time from Holden, so that's fun.
Anybody else have any comments or stories about Holden food?
One of the fathers that I met said that he brought his daughter here, she's 10, so probably 4 years ago. And he told her, he says, we're going back to Holden. What is it that you remember most? And she said, toast. It's very distinctive, toast.
Yeah.
I get toast whenever I want now.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it's that they really like the toast or they like watching it go through the toaster.
And the availability.
Yeah.
You know, whenever you want. I saw a little girl. In the old days, we used to eat cinnamon toast with sugar, and then I've changed to honey. This little girl had a good half inch of cinnamon sugar on a half inch piece of bread, and she was very proud of the fact that she was having cinnamon toast. So it's a combination of, I think, all of it. For a 6 year old, it's very distinctive.
I wonder if she's the one that came into the library with her cinnamon toast. She says, can I bring this in here? And I said, I doubt it, but go right ahead as long as you can.
Yeah, I don't think it was her. This little girl.
And she says, well, I have to get a couple books to read while I eat my cinnamon toast. Yeah.
She does whatever she wants. I'd like to make a comment on what he said. I'm gleaning as much as I can. I've been here for 8 days now, and I had no pre-knowledge of Holden at all, and I'm not Lutheran, so I'm a real anomaly. But I just kind of grab as much as I can. My roommate up there is Joel. He's been here since what, Joel? What? 50? No. 65.
Oh, you mean the first time I visited?
Yeah, 65. So he tells me stuff. But I'm horrible with names. I can remember Mary, but Werner? Is it Werner?
Oh, yes.
And I came to his sessions. And I just loved his methodology and his delivery. And part of it is what you just said, which I need to hear, because I hear all these glory stories of Holden, that it's the most wonderful, incredible, life-changing experience you're ever going to have. But he said it's a living entity. It is real. It is not a book in the library. It breathes. And situations occur in the winter. And that's what he said. He said his biggest fear was intellectual incest for the winter. And I've never heard anyone, I didn't know the test you talked about, but I'm very outgoing. I'm very out there, to the extent that I was telling you that I think it kind of upsets the introverted people. And I don't mean to be pretentious about it, but I'm an extrovert. I don't know how to be anything else, you know? I've worked in construction all my life, and if it doesn't move, you get a bigger hammer. You know? that's the way it worked. So it's interesting to know that it's a living, breathing animal, and that if you avail yourself, you will grow. And I find, because I'm in construction, I crawled under all the buildings the first day, and talked to all the squirrels and chipmunks and anybody else I've found under there. It's amazing, you know, for a structure that's 70, 80 years old to be in as good a shape as it is with volunteers.
Yes.
That, I mean, people who have skills or no skills are still under there doing the same thing, blows my mind. And I mean, I've been in construction for 40 years and I know how to do almost all of it. And to see a guy like Frank come in, who's a school bus driver, who can fix a vacuum cleaner, and he knows more than most of the engineers I've talked to. I mean, the guy's amazing. And totally unpretentious. Totally unpretentious. The fact that things work, I mean, they got copper, they got PEX, they got ABS, they got cast iron, they got everything under there. And Chris says, go down into the cellar and find a seat for the faucet. And I said, are you kidding? I spent 4 hours looking for one seat. I didn't find one. You know, but I found a washer that wouldn't fit, and I could get some sandpaper and sand it off and make it work, but the faucet still leaked. But there's only two leaky faucets in the whole place. Blew my mind. And I said, does every room have a sink? Really? And they don't leak? And the water you can drink, I'm from Southern California, the water you can drink out of the tap? That's unheard of, you know? The electricity's free. I run around turning all the lights off. They said, no, leave them on. We've got to, you know, make sure our energy consumption is even. You know, just a lot of stuff. And I attribute it to God. I really do. I don't think there's any way that human beings could pull this off. There isn't. Your music, and I congratulate you. You told the kids, hey, we got 6 months to pull this off. You didn't do it. God did it. You know, your wife, you didn't do it. God did it. You know, the stories that you tell, you didn't pull those off. They came out of this being available. And to me, it's amazing. It's absolutely, unequivocally amazing. So I'm a thank you person.
Thunder. Our first night here, I don't know if it was our first night, but a few days or so after we arrived, some friends asked us to ski up with them up to the third level, which is the highest point of the tailings there where you can look down. And we skied up there, and I looked down at this little village. Mm-hmm. See, after all these avalanche chutes and, you know, like you said, all the things, because I'm an engineer, I just, you know, saw all just mind-boggling, and thought how vulnerable this little place looks in all this vastness. Mm-hmm. And all these buses going up and down the road, road graders, and all the heavy equipment, logging, just on and on, all the projects that have been done and such. And I think it just hit me the other day. It's like the surprising gift term that's been used about Holden, you know, in the book called Surprising Gift, the surprising gift of Holden, you know, to the Lutheran Bible Institute via Wes Preeb's letters. That's a wonderful surprise. I think the really amazing thing to me and is that it's not just a gift, it's like that's continued for 50 years. I mean, that can't be explained through anything other than the miraculous, I think, time and time. The flip side of that time, when we would have the really hard times at Holden, you know, we kind of were just ready to throw in the towel and just head back to Wisconsin or whatever, and things would get, you know, we'd step back from it and say, you know, God, you seem to have a reason for this place to exist, because there's no logical explanation as an engineer that I can explain how this place has survived as long as it. And so we'll just kind of go in faith that you, for some reason, you want Holden to be here. We'll just do our part to keep that going, you know. And I remember one time, whenever I would leave to go out to do business, and back in those days before internet or anything, if you needed to do something, you had to go take 2 days, go down lake, you know, go to the hardware store or whatever, and then, or visit with the health department or get the permits for a project or something. And then every time I come back, people would mess with me and they'd make up some story about something really bad that had happened while I was gone, you know, just to kind of get my... And so one day I get off the bus, you know, and they say, oh yeah, Mark's been running the road grader and he hit the penstock and the hydro's down. Oh. And I'm like, oh, that's a good one. I haven't heard that one before. Like,
people know what a penstock is.
Penstock is the pipe that feeds all the water to the hydroelectric plant. And they said, no, really, he did. They pointed over there. And there's this jet of water shooting about 100 feet in the air up by the, on the other side of the river. And, you know, so the next 2 or 3 days are spent in this effort to get that thing welded. And it holds 280 pounds per square inch, by the way, I think is the PSI on that thing. And we had a young guy who was our mechanic.
And we were really running diesel generators.
We were running the diesel generators to keep the power
on. Other electricity at that point.
And we were running low on diesel.
I was going to say, you're almost out of diesel.
Yeah. Wasn't as bad as when we ran out of propane. We had to use the Hike House stoves to cook all the meals in the and that's another story. But anyways.
That really happened, too.
That happened, yeah. And so I'm finally, and every time they would weld this thing, and then we put the pressure to it, and it would start leaking again. And things got really weird. At the time, there was this giant cross that was up on the third level, and an electrician wired it, would light up at night. And
this was Holden hilarity.
Yeah, a giant cross that you sometimes see in over a little town or something. And it drove the executive director, Scott Osterwood, crazy. Just thought it was so tacky, but somebody put it up there. And we'd go on and off at weird hours at the time. It was on a timer. And then welders got to the point where they'd only weld when the cross was lit. That was really kind of superstitious. And I thought, things are just going downhill here really fast. So I was just about to get on the radio and call down late and bring a welder on a plane, get up here, a real welder. And then our head carpenter came to me and tapped me on the shoulder. And he's this he's this tall Danish fellow, very quiet, taciturn, Scandinavian kind of type of guy. And he goes, why don't you let me go up there and try? And okay, you know, and so he goes up, welded, you know, puts the pressure, thing holds just fine, powers back. I'm like, why did you tell me that you could weld? He's like, you never asked me. Exactly. But we have all sorts of characters and in situations. And speaking of food, I don't know if this says anything, but there was every year a crew of prisoners would come in and work down lake to do eradicate invasive weeds. And Holden's staff found out that the food that they served these prisoners was great. And they were like,
Was meat, right? Remember we were meat, going yes. Food chain?
So they would go down and load up a truck and come up with some excuse to go down to Lucerne and stand at these tables that they had, these standing things. They weren't allowed to sit down and give them these little plastic things. And all this Holden staff mixed in with all these guys in jumpsuits, eat the big, thick slabs of lasagna and, you know, tons of pork sausage in it.
I learned that right off the bat. The miners get meat. And the kids learn that the miners get dessert, so the kids are in there getting dessert.
Well, I'd like to piggyback on yours because you're a first-timer, and we're first-timers this year, and this will be a little different than the rest of your stories, I think, but I worked at a camp I had gone to who had a history going, well, I was 14 at the time, 15, but the camp goes back to 1925 and really 1914. That's a long history. So I was asked to work on our archival material this summer. And not having been a camper for all that time, they insisted, first of all, that I take part and do everything I had time to. Very little free time, but I was squeezed in interest groups here and there. One thing I learned at that camp that I see here a lot is that you run into people all the time that would be coming back to see how camp had changed and how it was the same. So he ran into a lot of things. Somebody first started by saying, and people come and they get upset about the things that have changed or not. But I found that people's loyalty is very strong, like it is here. There, very, very strong. And so a lot of these kids that are coming this year have aunts and uncles that go, you know, way back, you know, great grandma. So there's a lot of loyalty. So in our walking today, in our hike, we're saying, well, the places we've been, including this camp, Minnewanka is the same, what are the things that have contributed to the longevity of these places and to the extreme love and affection? And oftentimes, like you've said, with the greatest amount of things going wrong, they survive. And people are always, you know, hopeful that they'll continue. So we started kind of bisecting this most recent experience and looking at other places we've been here that have a lot of similarities. I don't know if you're familiar with the Navigators in Colorado Springs, there's a program that's like this, and yet it's not like this, and Minnewaka's like this, and YMCA camp in the Rockies, it reminds us a lot too, and other people, oh yeah, the Rockies. Yeah, Estes Park. And it's just fun to listen to all of you, because there is that similarity, though, of course, things that are very unique here, very different here, and we're just, it's beginning to unfold for us, so it's fun to see what you love most about this planet.
Mm-hmm. And going back through the history files, I came upon some material that was written for the Forerunners. The Forerunners were the first ones that came up and began setting things up, cleaning up the camp, because it had been abandoned for a couple of years. And it was one page, and it laid out a sequence for the day that is largely like exactly what we do now. I mean, you have matins, you have morning break, you have vespers, you have Bible study, and you have community conversation. And I looked at that and I said, my goodness sakes, all those years, and that format has hung in there. So, you know, from day one, there was something going on.
Yeah.
And then the most recent book that has been published in the context of the 50th, the 50, Holden, 50 Years of Reminiscing, or something, Reminiscences.
Directors.
Yeah, yeah, right. I think it's real apropos that the whole business is referred to by Paul Hinderle as God's joke. Referring back to the April 1st letter dates and things like that, but it really goes a lot deeper than that. You know, this isn't supposed to happen, so God's having a little bit of fun here.
I think it's the people that come here, though. I think truly it is. Somebody asked me, what's the most remarkable thing? And I said, the kids. The kids are amazing. You know, I was in my construction days. I also was a teacher. And I see kids smiling and having fun, and they can go wherever they want. Even little Jasper, who's only two, his mom and dad are over having a conversation, he's running around somewhere else. It's really cool. And I say, why are the kids so cool? Because their parents are cool. Because their parents have smiles. Right there's a couple of parents that have smiles. And they're giving those children that piece of toast. You know? And I just find that amazing, because I didn't do it for my kids, my parents didn't do it for me, and I wish I would have gleaned that earlier. And I'm not saying I was a bad parent or anything, but I'm saying there's so much to learn, you know? And I think you're teaching the young people how to learn it and where to learn it. And I haven't heard, except one two-year-old yell back at his mother. The kids are very respectful, very nice. The four-year-old would come up and have an eye-to-eye conversation and ask you what you're doing. I was dragging some hose across the thing, and I said, I'm trying to make a place for the squirrels to hide, you know, and they just got the things kicked out. They're just great kids. And I, as the extrovert, I go up and, you know what, you're a great parent. Good job. Keep it up, you know. Because I think it's important for us old people, not including anyone else, to tell the young ones that they're doing a good job.
Just talk to the young ones. It's fun to just visit with them.
Right.
Even the little wee ones. Yeah. It's just great stuff.
And 10 Japanese girls are going to go home and tell them that they met the typical Americans.
Isn't that a hoot?
Yeah, please. I want to share a memory about the early years, although we weren't here then. this is our third time here, and this time we're on teaching staff, and we were here 3 and 4 years ago when our son-in-law was on music staff. But the memory I want to share is one that is about Walt Bowman, who was one of the earliest program directors at Holden. And he...
That would be late 70s, early 80s, when the camp director was no longer program director for the first time. And I think they had three people that shared that for about 3 or 4 years, something like that, if I remember right. Walt was one of those people, so excuse me.
Walt and his family came to Columbus in the early 70s and became members of our congregation. And he was on the faculty of Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus. And we became very good friends with them, and their kids babysat ours, and we played bridge with them and did a lot of stuff. And we kept hearing about this place called Holden and how wonderful it was and how they went there every summer and they stayed and we ought to come, and we never got here. And Walt died probably 8 years ago or something like that. By then we'd become very close to him. He was one that encouraged us to go into our education business after we retired from our public teaching. And that's why we are writing our materials, and he wrote the foreword for our first book. But after he died, Jan was telling me about the early days of Holden when they were living here, and she said about the third year that he was program director, he noticed that the teaching staff kind of got, in her words, uppity, that they were the best of the lot of people here, and they thought they were better. And he said and felt very strongly that a place like this could not exist unless everybody was valued and all their work was equally valued, that everybody was important. And so he started that summer that every person on teaching staff or any other staff had to take their turn at either dish duty or sorting the garbage or any one of those things. And which I had substituted for our daughter the summer that they were up here, because she and her husband wanted to go on a hike with Chris and Sonia Sharon, who were program directors that summer, and had never had any time off. So I took our daughter's turn at the dish team, and Dick took care of the kids after Narnia so they could go. But I thought that was so like Walt to notice that there should not be class distinctions, that the place that's living in a remote wilderness like this must have equality and everybody's work must be equally valued. Mm-hmm. And I find that just super refreshing. And when you come here and you take your dishes over there and you see the main speaker for the week, who might be from mm-hmm. South Africa or someplace, and they're cleaning the dishes, it is just a really great, great thing.
Yes, it's really great.
The other thing that we heard about Walt was that one summer Herb Brokering was here as the person. And he was here quite a few weeks, I guess. And he and Walt had a really good relationship. And Walt got Herb to come to every session in the morning where Walt was the main theologian. And then afterwards they'd get together, and by the next morning, Herb would have written a song to be used in Vesper that night. And they just thought that was so amazing that relationship could happen and carry on.
Mm-hmm. I think that story is in the book that was just published. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
It
is. Yeah. It had a ring of familiarity to me.
Yeah. And their kids came out here every summer, too, and when we were here 3 summers ago, the family had a reunion.
Yes.
Right. And they were all here except Jan, whose health wasn't good enough to come. His wife couldn't come. But we ended up being on the same floor in the dormitories up there with them and reconnected with all of them again. And one day we were hiking, was it on the second or the third level? Anyways, we were up there, and here's Greg and Luke, and they're playing golf frisbee, because that's what they used to do when they were here as kids. They'd go up there and escape and play up there.
Yeah.
So it was really fun.
Yeah.
If I could continue that just a minute, I had a bit part in the Bowman story here too. Their youngest son, Greg, was a superb violinist when he was in high school. And he even soloed with our symphony orchestra and was clearly on the way to a music career. However, that music career had been maybe a little too strongly encouraged by a rather forceful father. And Greg did not play the violin once he got to Valparaiso. And he had been teaching in Cincinnati. He teaches literature, English, quite a few years before they came up for that family reunion. I said to Greg, you know, you left our church before you became really good on the violin so that you and I could play the Bach Double Concerto. And I'm a decent amateur violinist, and I had brought my violin that year because our son-in-law sort of twisted my arm as a music director here for a couple of weeks. So Greg says, well, why don't we do it now? I'll go see if I can find a violin. So we got a Holden violin, got a sponge out of the kitchen for his shoulder rest. And he gave a very moving 5-minute talk before we played that, essentially saying, his dad always wanted him to play this at Holden, and he always refused. So he says, this one's for you, Dad. And we played it.
And it was wonderful. Greg practiced that little bit that week, and it was perfect.
He could still play it really good.
Yeah, it was another miracle.
And he had not played since high school until he played that. He is playing now.
Oh, good. Well, we could go on because there are thousands of stories out there, but I think it's time to wind up. And I just appreciate all of you for contributing, adding to this wealth. People have been asking me, what are we going to do with all these recordings and stories I've taken down in journals? We have no idea.
It's going to go into the archives, that's for sure.
That is for true. You know, it's this wonderful wealth. It's the new gold, you know, that it will be mined in years to come. And we just felt that because this was a significant year, we needed to collect this, and then we'll figure out what to do.
The right person will come along. And
that's right. That's right. So thank you all very much. Have a good night.